listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And yes? Oh, great. Over the weekend, I was in Portland, Oregon, giving a TED Talk on, of all things, how our Supreme Court has been making laws. And I want to get into a conversation with Phyllis Schlafly about that. Although first, she's on a tear about something that I've been noticing. I saw these articles. I read the Financial Times, as you know, pretty much every day. And the U.S. is no longer, or China was, the headline is China poised to pass U.S. as world's leading economic power this year. China on top of the world. Uncertainty, not China replacing U.S. power. And so I thought that, you know, this sounds fascinating, too. So Phyllis Schlafly is a conservative author and activist, constitutional lawyer, and founder of the Eagle Forum. EagleForum.org is her website. And Mrs. Schlafly, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
So nice to have you with us. First of all, the Financial Times and China isn't... You know, as I'm sure you know, it was during the George Washington administration in 1793 that Alexander Hamilton presented his 11-point report on manufacturers, one of the major points being recommending a tariff on imported goods. And from the George Washington administration until the Reagan administration, we had basically about a 30% import tax on most things, at least most things that we could make here. And we made things here. And then Reagan and then Clinton, in a big way, with NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, you know, WTO, the whole bit, blew up all of this with free trade drop. Our average tariff now is around 2%. Is that not really what's going on here, that we shot ourselves in the foot, not that China shot us or whatever?
Well, yes, I think free trade has been a racket. The trouble with free trade is you expect rules to be established and obeyed by both sides. But in the words of the old slogan, it takes two to tango. And what's happened is that we obey the rules, but China doesn't obey them at all. And China is a complete mercantilist country that is doing everything about its economy in order to benefit it at the expense of everybody else.
Which is sort of the imperative for every country. I mean, that's basically what we did for 200 years, and that in and of itself isn't a bad thing.
Big and strong.
Yeah, and so I find these conversations fascinating. You're about as conservative as a person can get. I'm about as liberal as a person can get, and yet I think that we're seeing this in the exact same way. How do we take our trade policies back from the so-called centrists,
globalists.
Yeah, that's fine.
Who want to force Americans to compete with the low-wage, poverty-stricken people in other countries.
Yeah,
I don't see why we should.
Yeah, you're singing my song and Bernie Sanders' song. So how do we, you know, in the Democratic Party, there is a revolt brewing. The Progressive Caucus, which is 80, 90 members of the House of Representatives, just proposed a budget that included tariffs, that included, you know, basically repudiating free trade. And many of these folks have been on our program saying, let's get rid of this stuff. So that's happening. I mean, it's only about a third of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. I'm hearing not a peep out of the Republicans other than maybe Rand Paul. I'm not sure if it was his position on this. But how do we get our respective political parties, your Republicans, my Democrats, to wake up on this, that Ross Perot was right. This 30-year experiment in so-called free trade has been a disaster for us.
Well, I think we just have to keep telling the truth, because the American people understand this, and the American people are not for free trade. They see it's cost them jobs. And it used to be that the average guy with only a high school education could get a pretty good job, enough to support a full-time homemaker and buy or rent a house for his family and support his family. Mm-hmm. And they just can't do that anymore. And the globalists, they simply want to make us like other countries. And other countries are mostly have a few rich people at the top, and then everybody else is in dire poverty. That's what Mexico is. Mexico, I think, has got the richest man in the world.
Yeah, Carlos Slim.
Yeah, and so there are a handful of them at the top, and the rest of them are so poor they're willing to swim across the Rio Grande and tangle with our border guards in order to get into this country and make some kind of a life for themselves.
Yeah, yeah, and the answer to this has, I mean, in fact, if you want to talk immigration for a second.
Well, look, before, tell me, what sense does it make
if you produce
something in the United States, you're paying the highest corporate taxes of any country in the world. But if you build a plant overseas and build it and produce products overseas, you're not paying any income tax on it.
Yeah, and
so
we
well,
have.
What kind of sense does that make?
Well, it makes very little sense. The fact of the matter is that corporate America doesn't pay the highest tax. We have the highest tax rate. But in terms of actual payment, we're like 26th, I think, in the world in terms of collections. But your point is well made.
It's enough to induce them to have plants overseas.
Sure.
Now, China is so crooked. When they let us build a plant in China, they insist that the manufacturer give them their patents, their trade processes, all their know-how, and make China a partner in the management of the company.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think most Americans are just only now starting to figure out is that you don't just move one factory over to China or Vietnam or Mexico pick your low-wage country. It's not just that you start manufacturing, for example, GM was manufacturing Chevy engines in China. Because there's this whole thing called the supply chain. And, in fact, an Apple executive was talking about this a few weeks ago to the press about how, you know, if we need an extra $100,000 batteries, we can just, you know, snap our fingers and get it in a day and a half because the battery factory is right down the street from, you know, where the phones are built. Or if we need some extra chips or some extra screens, there's all these pieces to the supply chain. And we didn't lose just one factory. I mean, as Bernie Sanders pointed out on the show last week, just since 2000, we've had 60,000 factories in the United States close and go overseas.
It's really depressing because those are real people in this country, real jobs. Who men were supporting their families, and now they can't do it, and they've got to go take some minimum wage job somewhere and send their wife out to take another minimum wage job.
Yeah. And this is not good for America. In fact, you know, before 1980, the largest employer in the United States was General Motors, and what they paid in today's dollars was about $50 an hour. And today, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart, and they're paying on average around $10 an hour. And I think that tells the whole story of the collapse of the middle class. We're becoming the working poor. We're becoming, as you point out,
it sure does, and I'm maddest about their taking away my electric light bulbs.
Yeah, oh, really?
The plants here and open the plants in China instead.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't like those Chinese light bulbs.
Yeah, well, I'd be fine with them if they were made here in the United States. I'm with you on that. We're going to take a very, very short break. I want to talk with you about the Supreme Court. I read your book.
Eagleforum.org.
Yeah, and eagleforum.org is the website. But if you can hold on, Phyllis Schlafly will be right back with you. We'll be right back. Hang on just a second. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with Phyllis Schlafly in just a moment. Her website, eagleforum.org. Mrs. Schlafly?
Yes.
You're still with us. Great. Just so you know what's going on here, because you said you might be available for a half-hour conversation. We have a five-minute period here right now. We are still on the air. Our commercial affiliates, the commercial radio stations, which is about half...
5 minutes of ads?
No, well, yeah, it's about half our audience. They're listening to ads right now. The other half of our audience is listening to you and me, and that's our on Free Speech TV, on Dish and Direct TV in 60 million homes, on Armed American Forces Radio, on Pacifica radio stations around the country, on our nonprofit stations. So we can continue our conversation, and then I'll just resummarize it in 4 minutes when we rejoin our commercial stations, and then we'll go to the 28 minutes at the bottom of the hour, okay?
Okay.
Makes sense? Okay, so I read your book. Was the title The Supremes?
The Supremacists.
The Supremacists. Thank you. I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, they're the judges who think they're ruling the country.
Yeah. They are ruling the country, it appears. And I'm curious your thoughts about, some of the recent Supreme Court decisions. There was one last week where literally this wasn't the decision, it was the debate, but in the debate, they were deciding how to write the rules for, basically for the decision. What was that case? Oh, this was the cell phone. Whether you can search somebody's cell phone when you stop them at a traffic stop or something. And they were, the Supreme Court justices were debating among themselves, how do we write these rules? And I'm like, it's not your job to write the rules. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's right. And the Founding Fathers designed the separation of powers into three branches as the fundamental way that we would keep our liberty, because they weren't supposed to encroach on each other. But we've watched Obama, who now running an imperial presidency, he's just like and he thinks he can override that. For example, you saw him wave his pen around and said, well, if Congress doesn't pass the laws that I want, I'll just do it with my pen.
All right.
And so he does it that way and gets some of his bureaucrats in the executive branch to go ahead and write the law. And then likewise, the Constitution says that the president's job is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Well, if he doesn't like a law, he just plain doesn't enforce it. And he tells his attorney general, don't bother.
Although, in fairness, and I don't disagree with you in principle, although I tend to like him and you tend not to like him, but the fact of the matter is that Ronald Reagan did the same thing with the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982, and now we've got all these giant corporations that have basically squashed all the small companies and all the competition in America.
I don't know how to comment on that.
Okay. I'm just saying both presidents of both parties have done it. I can give you a list of complaints about Republicans.
It's unlikely that any president has ever done it to the extent that Obama has and bragged about it, too.
Yeah. But the Supreme Court...
The Supreme Court just plain thinks that it can do it, too. That's why I call them supremacists.
Yeah. And this is a power that is explicitly given to the legislative branch because we elect them. So we'll continue this conversation in about 30 seconds. So just hang on. We are talking with Phyllis Schlafly, conservative author and activist, constitutional lawyer, and founder of the Eagle Forum, eagleforum.org. We'll be right back. The conservative author and activist constitutional lawyer and founder of the Eagle Forum, eagleforum.org. Since our last conversation, which was a few weeks ago, I went online and I bought Phyllis Schlafly's book, The Supremacists, and read it. And, while, again, our politics are very different, and I would have picked different things to be outraged about, I think the idea that the Supreme Court has basically taken on a legislative role in writing laws is crazy. Mrs. Schlafly, you're still with us, right?
Yes, I
okay.
am.
Thank you so much. I had a couple questions that things I didn't know that I learned reading your book, and I'd like you to amplify on or just share with our listeners and our viewers. You pointed out, first of all, that for the first roughly century of the United States, certainly the first half century. I mean, we had Marbury versus Madison and Dred Scott, the only two times that the court was using judicial review to reject a law. But then, they started using judicial review a little more often, but it really has only been since the 50s, and I think you were assigning the Warren Court, the beginning point of that, that the Supreme Court has gone beyond saying, this is our decision in this case about this person, and instead has started saying, this is our decision in this case about this person, and therefore it applies to everything that might have anything to do with this. Oh, and by the way, here's the details of how the law should be as if we wrote it. Do I have that right?
Yes, you are, and that's why I call them supremacists, because they're trying to rule the country in ways that the courts were not designed to do. And if you really examine Marbury versus Madison, it was a much more limited decision. The one who completely understood it was Abraham Lincoln. And the most objectionable Supreme Court decision, I think everybody would agree in history, was the Dred Scott decision of the middle of the 19th century, which said that it was okay for a man to own a slave or own a person. And in faced with that Supreme Court decision, Abe Lincoln said, well, we have to accept what the court did to poor old Dred Scott, but we don't have to accept it as a national rule. We don't have to accept it as a precedent that will bind other cases, and we can hope that it's going to be overturned.
Right. And in fact, he issued.
If we submit to that type of rule by the Supreme Court, we've lost our right to self-government, and we are subject to what he called that eminent tribunal. And we don't want to be subject to that eminent tribunal. And so I'm really worried about what the court is doing to marriage now. Mm-hmm. Now, the Windsor decision last year did not make gay marriage a constitutional right, but they opened the door, and now all of these lower federal courts are chiming in to kind of expand it.
Well, and as I think
and
you
it's
and
not you, a it's not a court function,
right? And I think you and I had this conversation some maybe a year ago that had the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade in 73 not ruled the way they did and established law, you know, defined three trimesters, that it would have been worked out through the states and through the legislative process, and we probably would have eventually come to a national consensus. And instead, here we are 40 years later still fighting with each other about it.
Yes, there's a new book out, the name I've forgotten, but it's a very good explanation of all the mistakes and the violation of their own rules that the Supreme Court did in Roe v. Wade, which has brought us this problem.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the more obvious and well-known examples of the court literally writing law and putting it into law, and one with which I agree with you in your disagreement of it, although for different, you know, I would have.
Well, it was a legislative matter.
Yes.
And the courts grabbed it.
Yes, absolutely. So what do we now, you know, the Constitution not only does not grant these powers to the Supreme Court, but Article 3, Section 2 explicitly says that Congress not only can regulate the court, but can also define exceptions to what the court can rule on. So couldn't Congress simply pass a law saying the court cannot rule on issues of abortion or can't rule on issues of gay marriage or can't rule on issues of campaign financing?
And I've been a great advocate of Congress withdrawing jurisdiction from the federal courts over those areas where we don't trust them. And that would include marriage, the Ten Commandments, the Boy Scouts, and certain religion cases and so forth.
Yeah, and I have a list for myself, too.
But, you know, they're all scared to do it. And
why?
I find enormous timidity among the people in Congress in dealing with that issue. Now, when the Democratic Majority Leader, probably a friend of yours, was he from South Dakota? Was he named
Tom Daschle?
Well, you know, he didn't like what EPA was doing in certain areas of South Dakota, and he got Congress to pass, and it is the law, to take away jurisdiction from the court to handle those EPA rules in that area of South Dakota.
I saw that in your book, and it shocked me. So anyway, we'll have to continue this conversation another time, but I wanted to give it a good plug. I think it's a concept.
Glad to talk to you anytime. And in the meantime, my website is eagleforum.org.
You got it. I will plug it again in just a moment. Phyllis Schlafly, conservative author and activist, constitutional lawyer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Constitutional lawyer and founder of the Eagle Forum, the website eagleforum.org. We will be back. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, there's a bunch of stuff I want to share with you today. There's things to talk about. But first, I just want to kind of close up my conversation with Phyllis Schlafly, who I don't think that there is anybody in America, or very many people in America, with whom I more strongly and specifically disagree on issues than Phyllis Schlafly. And she knows it, and I know it. Yeah, I think she's wrong about the role of women in the workplace, in the home, about abortion, about, you know, I can give you a long list, right? You know, she doesn't like Obama. I more or less do. I mean, I can give you, you know, I'm not a fan of drones and all that kind of, but in any case. But there, what I hope my conversation with Phyllis Schlafly accomplished for you was a couple of things. Number one, that you come to clearly understand that there's a difference between principles and issues. This country was founded by people who starkly disagreed on issues. For example, the issue of slavery. The northern states were very opposed to it. The southern states, it was the only thing that made them viable economically. Not the only thing, but it was, you know, it was their thing. And that's one of many. So they disagreed on the issues, but they agreed on the principle that we should all get together and have a country. And here's how it should work. And in fact, that slavery itself over time should be phased out. You read the Constitution. It bans the importation of slaves after 1808. Now some would argue that was going to, you know, raise the price of, quote, domestically grown slaves or bread or whatever. Others argue, and Jefferson actually believed, that this would be the beginning of the end of slavery, that it would be gone within a generation. Obviously, it wasn't, and Dred Scott and a Civil War later, we began the process, and, you know, it still haunts us. It was one of the great sins. But without wandering off into a side discussion about that, the point is that Phyllis Schlafly and I find so few people on left or right understand the principle, even though we completely disagree on the issues, understand the principle that the Supreme Court's power is limited by the Constitution, that they are to be regulated by Congress. She gave the example of Tom Daschle actually regulating the Supreme Court. It's in her book. I don't think most Americans knew that. That not only does Congress have the power to regulate the Supreme Court, they've done it. They have passed a law. They have passed laws, and there's several of them in her book, actually. And there's probably liberal example. I mean, she's very partisan. Her book is very partisan. It's, very much, you know, the right is right and the left is wrong and all that kind of stuff. But set all that stuff aside and you get into the principle part of, out of the issues and into the principles. And the principles are quite clear. The Supreme Court is supposed to be the final court of appeal. I mean, at some point the buck has to stop. It has some very specific things in addition to being the final appeals court. It's the court that arbitrates international disputes that the United States is a party to. It's a court that is the final arbiter of maritime law. There's a list. You can read it in Article 3 of the Constitution. In fact, I'll share it with you. And then it says, in all other matters. So here, the judicial power, you know, shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, treaties, cases affecting ambassadors, admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, controversies to which the U.S. is a party, controversies between two or more states, between citizens of different states, between states, citizens of the states claiming lands of grant in different states, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In other words, they're the court that actually decides these things. You start with them. And then the second sentence of Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph 2. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions. And under such regulations as the Congress shall make. So the Congress could literally pass a law. I'm a big fan of amending the Constitution to get around the Supreme Court to say money's not speech and corporations aren't people. But arguably, you don't even need to do that. Congress could pass a law saying, basically stripping the Supreme Court or the entire federal court system of the right to assert that money is found in the First Amendment or the corporations are found in the 14th Amendment. Now, it would be very tricky. It would be very tricky, and it would probably provoke a constitutional crisis, and that's why, because then the executive branch would have to weigh in, and God only knows what would happen, and it could change from administration to administration, and the law could change from Congress to Congress, which is why I think it's better to simply amend the Constitution. But anyway, I said I had several goals in having that conversation, those two conversations with Phil Schlafly, one about tariffs and free trade, and the other about the Supreme Court. And one is to point out to you, to demonstrate, in your conversations with your friends and neighbors. I just came back from Portland. I was in Washington State and in Oregon on Thursday and Friday and Saturday. I gave a speech Thursday night in Washington, in Seattle, Friday night in Portland. And then Saturday I did a TED Talk in Portland, which will be up on the web, presumably in the next, I don't know how long it takes them to get these things up and out, but when they do, we'll stick it on our website. And in fact, I wanted to talk with you about my TED Talk because it was about corporate personhood and money as speech. But in any case, while I was there, I was visiting family. And although my political disagreements with Louise and I, with our three kids and her brother and his wife and her mother and, they tend to, our political disagreements tend to be fairly minimal. They weren't like my dad's were, when he was alive. My dad and I just disagreed on pretty much everything. I mean, he everything Phyllis Schlafly just said, my dad would have said. Well, not everything, but a lot of it. But on the principles, we agreed. And so I hope I was successfully modeling for you a way to have conversations with people who may be very different in their opinions about issues, to take that conversation out of the issue and to the principles so that you can find points of commonality, you can find points of agreement, and then from those points of agreement, we can work to make this a better country. If we can see, what's happened here is that our principles are all screwed up. Congress is not doing its job with regard to the Supreme Court or any damn other thing. The president, frankly, has not been doing his job, in my opinion, using the bully pulpit. He's not been speaking out the way he could. And the Supreme Court has been doing their way more than their job, and they've been doing it badly. So I think it's an important time for us to be reaching out and having a conversation with people with whom we vehemently disagree about the principles by which a democratic republic can function or is failing to function, whether it's the Supreme Court or whether it's international trade. Rather than simply, it would be so easy to say, okay, let's fight about the issues. And I've done that before with Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, she's been on this program probably 10 or 15 times in the last 10 years. And up until the last two conversations, she would come on and she would say something about, you know, the role of women in society, and I would argue with her, and we would have a fight, and that would be the end of it. And then I discovered her writings on the Supreme Court. I was like, wait a minute. There's a conversation to be had here. Okay, so I wanted to share that with you, and I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. I see a whole lot of people want to weigh in on this. We'll pick up your phone calls in a few minutes. The other thing that I think is fascinating is, did you know that there's this, you know, this group that is trying to take over the state of New Hampshire? Libertarians? They're trying to get 20,000 people to move to New Hampshire, which they think is a critical number. They've basically started with the city of Keene. Louise and I almost bought a house in Keene. I'm very familiar with Keene. I mean, we nearly bought this house. We spent a lot of time in Keene, New Hampshire. And it's a nice little town of maybe, I don't know, 10, 20,000 people, you know, in the mountains in New Hampshire. The live free or die state. And there are these people who are running around. Whenever they see a parking meter expiring, they drop a dime in it and they put a card. They call themselves Free Keene. They're libertarians. They're trying to create a libertarian paradise. And they stick a card on the windshield that says, you've been freed from having to, we saved you from the king's tariff. Article about it today by Dan Barry in today's New York Times. Libertarians trail meter readers telling town live free or else. And it's creating a huge problem in this town. In fact, now there's a Facebook page called Stop Free Keene, where the people of Keene are saying, who asked you to come free us? It's just fascinating.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anyhow, we'll continue our conversation here about, you know, Phyllis Schlafly and about the Supreme Court, about international trade and all this. Just and welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Westbrook, Connecticut, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, John, you're on the air. What's up?
Yes, sir. Thank you. It's really an honor, Tom. I started watching your conversation with Mr. Schlafly, and I think you're spot on. I can't say much except that if you two were joined at the hip, you should run for president. Because it is true that principles and truths kind of get confounded, you know. But
yeah,
it seems to me that you two have something of the future of the country at hand.
Well, you know, I you'd get a very different country if Phyllis was running it than you would if I was running it. I mean, you know, she is Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon all the way, and I am Bernie Sanders all the way.
I mean, well, I'm aware of that. But look, you two were able to speak, you know?
Yes.
And we see that little of that out in front.
Yes.
By the way, I for some time been wondering what was entirely wrong with the idea of taxation and globalization. Mm-hmm. There ought to be a way, kind of a meme, that when a company goes somewhere else, that it enhances the life in that country, not takes advantage of it. I realize that's a little too idealistic for me.
No, there's a fascinating article about this in the Financial Times last week. I think it was last Wednesday. Wednesday was the last day I was on the air here, and I read it on this computer, so it must have been last Wednesday. And it was about the Ireland shuffle or something like that. There's a name for it now that businesses are doing. And the reason why Pfizer wants to buy out AstraZeneca, I think it is, or something like that. You know, one of these big pharmaceutical companies based in the U.S. is trying to make a hostile purchase of a pharmaceutical company based in the U.K. that has offices in Ireland. And the reason that they're doing it, the reason that they're trying to do it, is so that they can move their legal headquarters from the U.S. to Ireland. And Irish tax law allows them to keep any profits, if it allows them to move those profits to the Bermudas or the Bahamas, whichever it is, where there's no corporate income tax. And basically, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar acquisition, but they will save hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in taxes that they're paying to the federal government. So they will get to continue to use us as their customers. They will continue to have an educated workforce paid for by us. They will continue to use our roads and our commons and our air traffic control system and our courts to enforce their contracts and our Obamacare to pay for their pharmaceuticals. They'll continue to have all the benefits of being a corporation doing business in the United States. But if they can just merge with this foreign corporation and start running their operation, running their money through Ireland and the islands in the Caribbean, then you know, they get to screw us and make a lot of more profit. And they're getting some pushback now from this company that they're trying to acquire, because the company realizes now that it's just, this is just a tax dodge. This isn't an actual, you know, good strategic merger. But Apple has been doing this for a long time. General Electric has been doing this for a long time. Microsoft has been doing this for a long time. And the problem, it's not like these are rogue companies. It's that it's a rogue law. It's, you know, our
right,
tax.
Right, sure. You got to change the law. You can't change the company. They're just going to take advantage of it.
That's right. That's right. And this again, is one of those areas where I think Phyllis Schlafly and I would agree in principle. She, you know, we would disagree on the policy, you know, but we would agree on the principle that this is something that should be done. You know, these laws should be done for the benefit of the United States. We may have differences of opinion about what that would be. John, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Connecticut. We'll be right back. There's line 12. I want to drop a quick note in here, particularly for our listeners in Washington State. Libby Carr is the campaign manager, but not just for Washington State. You can do this in your state, too. Libby Carr is the campaign manager for the Washington State Coalition to Amend the Constitution, wamend.org, as in WashingtonAmend.org. And this is basically the constitutional amendment that Move to Amend is promoting. And, Libby, are you the person I met at that talk in Seattle?
I sure am.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. I'm glad you followed through and contacted Sean. And I just wanted to get you on to tell people what you're doing and how people can get in touch with you. Because, as you pointed out, you need to get a couple 10,000, 20,000 more signatures on this thing to get this on the ballot.
No, Tom, I'm afraid it's more like 300,000.
300,000, okay. So give us the details.
Yeah, it's a lot more. We've got right now about 60,000 from our dedicated volunteers, and we need about 300, 3.25 to feel comfortable, to have a margin of safety there.
Mm-hmm.
So we are at a point where we need to hire paid signature gatherers to help in that effort, as well as still our volunteers.
Okay.
And we are now, we will be the 17th state in the country to publicly state, either through the state legislature or through the ballot, that we want to amend the Constitution.
To say that corporations are not people and money is not speech.
Right. Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. And all political contributions must be regulated and disclosed.
Yep.
Just exactly like Move to Amend. They're very close friends of ours. In fact, Caitlin sits on our board and has worked with us very closely.
Marvelous. Marvelous. So let me, people,
organizations.
People can help you out by going to wamend.org. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's wamend.org. We have donate buttons all over the place there.
Right.
And we had a really great announcement the day after I spoke with you, and that is that a very dedicated local supporter gave us a $50,000 challenge grant.
Whoa.
Yeah,
so,
and
so you need to raise
dedicated to this issue.
So everybody who gives money now will see that money doubled up to $50,000.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's marvelous. That's marvelous.
Exactly.
Libby, I've got to get back to my show here and to my other callers, but I wanted to give you a good plug on the air, and we will do it again as time goes on. Call in at least once a week, would you? And keep us up to date on how things are going.
Absolutely. And okay. I also just wanted to say we will pay any remains of this campaign forward to the next state.
Great.
Doing the same thing. And we think that could be a real powerful message and movement.
Great. And if you want to do something like this in your state, contact Libby over at WMN.org. Is that okay to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Okay. Libby, thank you. You are a hero or a heroine. You are doing wonderful work.
Well,
thank you. Thank
Tom, you've put this issue on the map for all of us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to put you on hold here, and Pete can say thank you. And let's get back to some of these issues that we've been talking about. Lawrence in Berkeley, California, listening on WCPT's website. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? I wonder if you remember the time when I called up Bernie Sanders and asked him if Congress could overrule Citizens United and now McCutcheon by telling the Supreme Court under Article 3, Section 2, that they don't have jurisdiction.
I do remember, and he was unaware of that, yeah.
Well, no, it was worse than that. He said, no, you can't do it because that would be an ex post facto law.
Yeah.
And I think he's right. I think you cannot directly annul a Supreme Court ruling in Congress. However, there is a way around it. And that is that you'd have to do it in two steps. One is that you'd have to make a new law.
Right.
That, you know, that says that, okay, money may not be spent in these ways from corporations, et cetera.
Right.
And then after you do that, then you can use Article 2, you know, Article 3, Section 2, which says, okay, with such exceptions as
right.
Congress shall make, and then you can say Congress may not rule on campaign finance or Congress may not rule.
You mean the Supreme Court may not rule.
Money speech. And if you have a new law, it's not ex post facto anymore. It's a new law, which then would have to be ruled on, and you say, no, you can't.
Right.
And
yeah, it makes perfect sense. Lawrence, it makes perfect sense. By the way, one of our underwriters, proflowers.com, is giving away, would like us to give away some flowers for Mother's Day. Would you like some?
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you this?
Well, can you answer my question?
I'm sorry, I missed it.
May I give you a ProFlowers certificate so you can give somebody some flowers for Mother's Day?
Oh, yay!
Okay. When we're done, I'm going to put you on hold instead of dropping the call. You had a very quick question. Can we make it
yes.
very...
I want to ask you if you will mention that to Bernie. It's a lot harder to get a hold of him than it is you.
Yeah, it's, you know, when he's here on the air, it's pretty much his show, but I do talk with him occasionally off air, and I will bring that up. Thank you, Lawrence. I appreciate the call. And Lawrence is on line two. And Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Devon, got a minute to go here.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Kudos to you for being a civics teacher, man, and America so needs what you're delivering. It's funny, I had just had my sixth grade social studies teacher is on Facebook, which is awesome. And we had a little exchange today about Barry Goldwater. I grew up in Arizona, and she taught there for a number of years, social studies. And there's a video called Mr. Conservative that's it's a documentary about Barry Goldwater. And while I disagree with him on so many major points, not the least of which was nuking Vietnam, he was a man of principle.
He was.
And his thoughts evolved. He came to accept, in part because his grandson, came out of the closet, so he came to accept that people who are homosexual are people just like you and me.
Yep, he said you don't have to be straight to shoot straight. And I remember reading No Apologies, his autobiography, about 10 years ago when I started this show. Devon, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. Thank you for your kind words.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, let's just say it. You know, I mean, just flat out. America, by and large, particularly corporate America, throughout our media, America, by and large, doesn't give a rat's ass about poor people. Case in point, what's going on in West Virginia right now? Almost 4 months after 10,000 gallons of a toxic coal cleaning chemical known as MCHM leaked into the Elk River and poisoned the water supply of hundreds of thousands of West Virginians. The federal government is just now starting to look into what happens to people who inhale that chemical. Over the next couple of months, the EPA is going to take vapor samples and try to establish some sort of a safe inhalation limit. Now, while any action is better than no action, this investigation is too little too late. And that's because it doesn't do anything to help the 300,000 plus people who are already exposed to MCHM vapors when the chemical started leaking into their water supply in January. As Dr. Rahul Gupta of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, this is West Virginia, told the Charleston Daily Mail, quote, "I am at a loss as to what the utility is to the 300,000 people already exposed to MCHM from this particular test." Of course, it would be one thing if the public knew about the long-term exposure effects of MCHM, but it doesn't, and it probably won't for years, maybe decades, before we know how destructive the Elk River spill really was. But to add insult to injury, if this recent information is all news to you, that's sadly not surprising. Although the Elk River spill was national news back in January and February, it's fallen off the radar of the mainstream media ever since. And these people are still suffering from this stuff. So why is it no longer in the media? Well, because West Virginia is mostly full of poor people. And it's mostly poor people who are being hurt by this spill. That's why. Had the Elk River spill occurred in the Hudson River off the wealthy upper west side of Manhattan or in the Potomac River along the upscale Georgetown waterfront, it would be the top story on mainstream network and cable news shows every single night. And can you imagine what the reaction would be if toxic chemicals leaked into New York City's water supply and it took the EPA 4 months to figure out how dangerous it was to inhale those chemicals? But because the Elk River spill happened mostly in rural, poor, and economically depressed West Virginia, no one in the mainstream media cares. In fact, its silence on the ongoing environmental disaster in West Virginia is pretty representative of the state of the country these days. While we're outraged that an old racist like Clippers owner Donald Sterling smears a wealthy African-American like Magic Johnson, you know, we really need to own up to the fact that we never had a national conversation about this guy's ideas on race during the decades that he's been discriminating against his impoverished black and Latino tenants. And while Congress can find the time for yet another trip down the Benghazi rabbit hole, it still hasn't extended unemployment benefits or raised the minimum wage. Two things that would actually help struggling Americans. Everywhere you look these days, the two main institutions that should protect the powerless, our media and our government, are standing idly by as our country marches through a new Gilded Age. After all, as I'm sure you're going to see on the corporate news shows this week, and this coming Sunday's Meet the Republican news shows, you know, every Sunday all three networks have a, "It's time to meet the Republicans. Face the Republicans. What are the Republicans talking about?" Why talk about poisoned poor people in West Virginia when there's fancy rich people at the White House Correspondents' Dinner? It's all about the money. It's all about the money. I think, if anything, and I think I mentioned this on Wednesday, just as I was wrapping the show up, that I've been kind of chewing on this for a couple of days and not quite sure how to say it. But But the fact of the matter is that Don Sterling has been financially, and not just, well, not just financially. I mean, if you're denying somebody housing, whatever you, however you want to say it, not just discriminating against people, screwing people, hurting people, harming people of color, people of color, and people who are poor. For much of his life, if not most of it. I mean, this guy got rich becoming a slumlord. He's a billionaire. By virtue of his properties in mostly the L.A. area. And nobody was hysterical about that. And it was a whole lot more. How many guys are there on an NBA basketball team? What, 18, 13, 12? I don't know. I don't know how many people are on a team, but whatever. It was, you know, he was doing this to thousands of people, or maybe hundreds of people. There was a lawsuit. He settled out of court for a couple million bucks. And nobody said anything. Mr. Silver, the baseball commissioner, or the basketball commissioner, didn't say, okay, that's it, you're out. But when he messed with, and this is messing with poor black people. But then he starts messing with rich black people. And at that point, you can take the word race out of the discussion. I mean, the race was almost the MacGuffin, you know, the word that Alfred Hitchcock invented to describe the plot device. Yes, the guy's a racist. And it's not a problem for decades if he's a racist against poor people of color. But when he goes against rich people of color, see, this is why I keep saying there are issues of class here in the United States that we don't talk about. We try to pretend it doesn't exist. Oh, we're all the middle class. No, I'm sorry. There's a lot of us who are the working poor and worse. The middle class is shrinking. Nobody knows what middle class means, even. Europeans understand it. The difference between the working class and the middle class. Americans don't. And we don't like to have conversations about class in this country. So we use race as a proxy for it in some ways. And not just race. I mean, this is a great example of what I was talking about in the last hour, about the difference between principles and issues. Right, with the Don Sterling thing. And it's people, oh, Phyllis Schlafly, oh my God, she hates women, isn't she terrible? Yeah. I've had David Duke on this program. He hates black people. I mean, it's not, and what was the conversation with David Duke about? How do we create a government that's responsive to we the people? Principles, not issues. Everybody thinks that the Don Sterling thing is about the issue of race, and it's there. And but that's been 99.99% of the conversation. But there's a principle at work here. And that is that as long as he was kicking the ass of poor people, there was no conversation in the media. He was able to keep his basketball team all he wanted. But when he started kicking the butts of rich people or slurring them, then it's like, oh, get this guy out of here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And this, that's the principle, right? And it's a principle that's not discussed enough in the United States, that we worship the rich. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I hope I hope I'm making sense of this stuff. It's like I'm you know, sometimes these issues are subtle enough that they just kind of fly over people's heads. Or they get so caught up in the issue that they miss the principle that I'm really trying to get at. on the other hand, I find, you know, not only do most of you absolutely get what I'm talking about the difference between issues and principles and what the principles are versus what the issues are and who the people are and you know, what we're trying to do with this program. Not only do most of you get it, but I learn a lot from you. So I just, you know, I'm not complaining. I am complaining, however, about our corporate media, which does not want to have a conversation about principle and only wants to talk about issues and only in the most partisan of ways and only in the most irrelevant and partisan of ways. So this whole Benghazi thing in Fox News is a great example. You know, oh, my God, we had an intelligence failure and four guys died. And we've got to hold the president accountable. Okay, cool. What's the biggest intelligence failure we've had in the last 15 years? 9/11. Where's the call to hold George Bush accountable? Oh, wait, you know, we don't want to talk about the principle of holding presidents accountable. We want to talk about the issue of Benghazi. Give me a break. Brent Baer trying, you know, pretending that he's like some kind of serious journalist and then spreading lies about Benghazi. It's just sad. Anyhow, Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny. You wanted to know if Phyllis Schlafly has read The New Jim Crow? I'd be surprised.
Yeah, or Matt Taibbi, for that matter. And that brings to the point. You know, as hard as you try, I give you an A for your effort in trying to reach out and be reasonable to her, at least on the air, the conversation that you had for our benefit. But it's people like her and that NBA owner, Sterling,
right,
and Cliven and Bundy, they're all cut from the same cloth. When you confront them, even in a nice way, with a fact, you brought up Ronald Reagan, all of a sudden there was a big silence, a big pause. And then she says, well, I don't know how to respond to that.
Right.
That's right. You don't know how to respond.
Well, I think
to
she
that
didn't know how to respond because she's been living. I don't want to speak about Phyllis, but in general, typically when people don't know how to respond to those, it's because they've been living in a bubble. And things are getting worse, frankly, Johnny, now with the Internet. You can read nothing but left-wing websites and nothing but right-wing websites. And there are, I mean, I have, and I don't read the right-wing websites enough, and I don't watch Fox News, and so occasionally there'll be some story that's just huge on the right. And some right-winger calls in and goes, oh, what about this or that? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And we're siloing ourselves.
That's my point. Part of the problem, the big part of the problem, is on the media side, is that we have a fractured media. This is not a three-broadcast network society anymore.
I know.
Where it's easy to have a cohesive society. Now, everyone can stay in their own little bubble, just like you said.
Yeah.
And in spite of the efforts of independent media, free speech TV, even on the commercial side with MSNBC evening programs, you still have to reach a lot more people than what we're reaching, obviously, because we don't have enough of that conversion going on.
I agree. And this is also one of the reasons why I want to have on conversations with people that normally wouldn't be in a progressive venue. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Good talking. Suppose has a right to free speech. This is interesting. Ed in Klamath Falls. You wanted to say that Don Sterling has a right to free speech?
He absolutely does.
Yeah.
The woman that he was talking to, it was his paid escort. He's paying millions of dollars a year for her, I assume, to have sex with him. Instead, he finds the woman hanging out with Magic Johnson. I don't follow sports much, but I think he's the guy that admitted to having sex with over 1,000 women, and he has AIDS now, doesn't he?
No. I think you're thinking of Wilt Chamberlain, if I remember correctly. But whatever it may be, Ed, there is no. If you're trying to rationalize justify what Sterling said,
that conversation took place, I think, in his house.
That's right.
Your hair would be on fire if the NSA released something that you said in your own house.
Yes. You're right. And this woman has come out and said that she did not release it. There was a third party in the room, and that she actually has said her position on this, and I mean, who knows what the truth is that not that she's a paid sexual escort or girlfriend even, but that she was basically his personal assistant, and that he had asked her to record 100 hours of him, you know, which would probably be, you know, a day for a week or thereabouts, so that he could see what he was remembering and what he wasn't. It sounds to me like this is a guy who's early Alzheimer's and knows it and is trying to figure out what he's missing and what he's forgetting. And, you know, whether she was baiting him or exploiting him or, you know, whatever, I don't know, and I don't frankly care. You know, he certainly has a right to Free Speech TV. He doesn't have a right to own an NBA team. That's a privilege.
He has a right to say what he wants to his employee in his own house and expect that it remains private.
Yeah, to expect that it remains private, but it didn't remain private. And so are we supposed to pretend it wasn't said?
Again, you know, she can say she's not a paid sexual escort.
No, Johnny, or Ed, excuse me. Are we supposed to pretend that it wasn't said because he had no intention of it being said in public?
Again, I think what a man says in private to the woman he's having sex with is his business.
Yeah.
It's pretty much like what you say to your wife.
Okay, so you would say that his conversation was irrelevant.
It
was privileged. But in any case, that the NBA should not have stripped him of his right to go to his own games.
They've known that everybody's known who he was for years and
well,
years.
Well, that was my point earlier on. Ed, you know, thank you for the call. James in Spokane, Washington. Hey, James, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
First, there's one point I didn't mention before. I want to mention briefly. Every time a Republican mentions the word Benghazi, there should be a one-word response, and that should be Iraq.
Yeah. Or 9/11.
Okay, now about the poisons in West Virginia, God bless those people. That stuff is being put on all the coal we burn in this country, and we burn a lot of coal.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a national experiment, not just a West Virginia experiment. Interesting point. Thank you for the call. Eric in Tacoma, Washington, listening on AM 1030. Hey, Eric, what's up?
I thought you'd be interested in a solar breakthrough that was announced on the Science Today website. Synthesized solar jet fuel, renewable kerosene from sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide. And the process essentially is taking concentrated sunlight and using carbon dioxide and water into a synthesized
right, which
jet.
Is how plants do it.
Yeah, and then it converts that, and you convert that to kerosene, but you can also convert it into diesel or other fuels. And,
right.
And this fuel has already been approved for commercial airplanes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I was, you know, I flew United last weekend, and when I called to make my reservation, I was on hold, and the little voice on hold said, did you know that United has started using, you know, mixing renewable fuels in with its fossil fuels? I was like, whoa, you know, it's like, you know, big corporations, they're starting to pay attention to us. It's like, that's very interesting. Eric, thanks for the tip. Stefan in Stockholm, Sweden. Stefan, a little less than a minute before we got to hit a break here. What's up?
All right. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Stefan.
Yeah. You know, I just want to make a comment about the death penalty in America. I think it's just so stupid.
Yes. I agree.
Yeah, you know, what is the right with the government to execute a man who has committed maybe a heinous crime? But if the state and the country decide that this person should be executed, isn't that just as bad?
Yeah, I think it turns us all into killers. It coarsens us. Stefan, thank you for the call. Excellent point. And, in fact, I don't think we've had that happened just before I headed out of town, didn't it? So we haven't had an opportunity to talk about that on the radio. We'll bring that up after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think this botched execution attempt in Oklahoma just demonstrates the stupidity of the state trying to kill people. The good, the bad, and the very, very hortulently ugly, the good. Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, and I don't agree on a lot of things, but believe it or not, we have the same idea about what to do about the Los Angeles Clippers now that the NBA is making Donald Sterling sell the team. On Thursday, Gingrich sent out a tweet saying, quote, "The right answer to the Clippers' ownership challenge is to sell it to the people of Los Angeles. Green Bay, not billionaires, is the model." Well said, Mr. Speaker. Now, if only we could get you to feel the same way about every other part of the comments. The bad. Ray Moore, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, has some pretty crazy ideas about the First Amendment. He told a recent Pastor for Life luncheon that its freedom of religion clause only protects Christians. Seriously, check it out.
Everybody, to include the United States Supreme Court, has been deceived as to one little word in the First Amendment. Called religion. They can't define it. They can't define it the way Mason, Madison, and even the United States Supreme Court defined it. The duties we owe to the Creator and the manner of discharging it. Well, they don't want to do that because that acknowledges the Creator God. Buddha didn't create us. Mohammed didn't create us. It's the God of the Holy Scriptures. They didn't bring a Koran over on the pilgrim ship Mayflower.
Actually, maybe they did. I don't know. Jefferson had one. Anyway, did I mention that this guy is the Chief Justice of Alabama's Supreme Court? That's pretty insane. And the very, very ugly Mike Christian. Although last week's botched execution of convicted murderer Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma is making many Americans do some deep soul searching about the death penalty, Oklahoma State Representative Mike Christian is doubling down on his support for capital punishment. He told a local news station on Sunday that he doesn't care whether inmates are executed by injection, electric chair, firing squad, hanging, the guillotine, or being fed to the lions. I think it's safe to say that when public figures start celebrating how the Romans executed people, there's something wrong. I mean, why not go all the way and start crucifying people again? That's just very, very ugly. Actually, maybe he'd want to do that. I don't know. It's pretty incredible. Nick in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, Nick, you're on the air.
Oh, how's it going, Tom?
Very, very good, thank you. You are a pilot?
All right, sorry. I am. Sorry, I was head on speaker. I heard the gentleman who called up, and I had to pick up the phone in regards to the use of renewable fuel for aircraft.
Right.
And I wanted to give an example, just to kind of give, I guess you'd say, people an idea.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a difference it would make when you fly, like you said, you flew United last week.
Yeah.
If you fly, like United to Florida, for example, you're going to fly like an Airbus A320. Now, gas in aircraft isn't measured in gallons, it's measured in pounds. So it's 6 pounds a gallon.
Right.
You will use approximately like 30 to 35,000 pounds of fuel, which equivalates to between like 4,500 to 5,500 gallons just
right.
to get to Florida. If that was renewable, that would be just tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say reduce global warming by maybe tenfold and, I don't know, make a big difference because that was just like a basic example I could give you off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, this is aviation is the last frontier that has not been breached. We have figured out mass transit. I mean, all over Europe, they've got electric trains that are, you know, and China now, and I mean, all of these trains. Very, very few of them are even running on diesel fuel anymore like ours do. And the ones that we have are hybrids, you know, 500 miles per gallon.
It's disgusting.
And we've got cars figured out. You know, we've got everything figured out for electricity except for commercial aviation. And if we could go renewable with commercial aviation. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of things. I think aviation's behind the times and everything. Regulations. I don't know if you saw I think she was a spokesperson for Washington, called out to FAA about the air traffic controllers, biographical screening exams and the new regulations and
I don't know about that. Oh, and we just lost the caller. Okay, yeah, I don't know the details about that. But I do know that United is mixing renewable fuels in with their jet fuel, and I think that's kind of cool. Anyhow, Ken, in, or at least that's what they're telling us when you're on hold. Ken in Geneva, Illinois. Hey Ken, what you wanted to talk about the Supreme Court?
Yes, we talked last week about definition of arms in the Supreme Court.
Oh yeah, you were saying that arms included knives and baseball bats and things.
Right,
and shields.
The Supreme Court in 1936 changed arms to the guns.
Right.
And I don't think the Supreme Court should be able to change the words in the...
Well, I'm sure they would say that they clarified the meaning of the words, because you also suggested that the word arms could mean financial damages as well, right?
Colors and the...
Oh, that's right, the flag. The flag. You carry the flag into battle, right, that the Second Amendment guarantees.
That's the only thing when you say arms.
That's right.
It doesn't have another definition.
Yeah.
Another meaning, like... Right. Weapons.
Yeah, this coat of arms. Our flag is is the coat of arms for our nation. Yeah, excellent point, again, Ken. And do you know what the name of the case was in 36?
No, I don't. And I didn't. I don't know what they were arguing. I don't think they were arguing about the name or the arms.
Yeah. So it was. It was said parenthetically.
I don't think they. Supreme Court has a dictionary back in that time. They have to know what those words meant at that time.
Yeah, if they want to be true to the original intent of the founders. On the other hand, you know, many of the founders were slaveholders. This country has changed and evolved a lot since the founding of the Republic, and there were many of the founders, Jefferson probably the most outspoken among them, who felt that every 20 years we should revisit everything, you know, basically reboot the Constitution. So, Ken, thank you for the call. There's a new book, John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court justice who's still alive and kicking. He's in his 90s. Has a new book out with 6 proposed amendments to the Constitution. One of them is to say that money is not speech for the purposes, of financial campaigning, basically, which I thought was kind of cool. Nicole in Williamsfield, Ohio. Hey, Nicole. Thanks for listening to Progressive. Is that... the Progressive Voices?
Progressive Voices, yes.
Great. Hi.
Hi. I was calling because I heard you speaking to a lady earlier about getting money out of politics through this WAMEND.
Yeah, WAMEND.org. It's the Washington State effort to amend, to support a federal amendment to the Constitution to say that money is not protected by the First Amendment and corporations are not protected by the 14th Amendment, 2 laws or policies that have been created exclusively by the Supreme Court. Yes.
Okay. I thought that maybe she'd like, if she's still listening or if not, you could let her know that we also have another group out there that's called Wolfpack that's... trying to go through all of the states and, you know, call for a convention in order to add a 28th Amendment to the Constitution, which would end corporate personhood.
Right. Yeah, that's what she's talking about, too. There's a bunch of different groups who are working on this, and MoveToAmend.org is kind of at the center of most of it. They're a very good coalition builder. But
right, and through Wolfpack, Vermont is our first state that has already had a vote through both the House and the State Senate to go ahead and move forward with, getting this convention going.
That is great. That is great. Nicole, thank you for sharing that, and I appreciate it. Well said. Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to talk about the petroleum cancer connection.
Sure.
Okay, we spend billions of dollars in cancer research, and one way to slow cancer is to stop using petroleum, because here in California we have Proposition 65 that says, warning, chemicals known to the state to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm are found in gasoline, crude oil, and many other petroleum products. Their vapors are results from their use. So our cancer is an externality to the oil companies. They get the money, we get the cancer. And I'd like to, you know, there's a website called, if you go to Google and you put in the words plug-in vehicle tracker, P-L-U-G-I-N-V-E-H-I-C-L-E-T-R-A-C-K-E-R, plug-in vehicle tracker. They show all the electric cars, bicycles, trucks, motorcycles, vans, everything. And I think that if we want to get away from cancer, we got to get away from petroleum. So it's time to plug our vehicles into the nearest star, the sun, and let's get solar.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, it's amazing to me how people get so into these, race for the cure and shave your head for the cure, and nobody mentions that maybe we should shave our heads or have a race to ask the petroleum industry to pay for the cancers that they're causing. Denmark did this. Denmark raised the tax on gasoline by a little over a dollar a gallon, and they did so because they calculated that that was the cost of the cancers and asthmas and respiratory diseases associated with burning gasoline in their country, the cost to their National Health Service. And so they said, okay, this is what it's costing us, and then we're going to charge. We're going to charge the oil companies, basically. And they did that more than a decade ago. And we don't even have a conversation about it. You're absolutely right, Harvey. A large number, nobody knows what the real number is, but some statistically significant number of cancers in the United States are externalities of the oil industry, and they don't pay a penny.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's classic capitalism. I mean, this is unregulated capitalism, Ayn Rand capitalism. Internalized profits, externalized costs. Welcome back. Bill in Gardnerville, Nevada. Hey, Bill, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about Benghazi?
Yes, I sure did. You know, I've watched about 100 hours of coverage on Benghazi and just about every station known to man, and I still haven't had one of my questions answered. Number one, is this a rental? Did we lease this? Are we buying it? Did we just take it over?
What's the it that you're talking about?
Yes, the facility in Benghazi.
Oh, it was. That's a good question. In other words, it wasn't an embassy. It was a consulate. We own that building or did we rent it from somebody? I don't know the answer.
Yeah. And who mows the lawns? And who trimmed the hedges?
Uh-huh.
And who maintains the swimming pool?
Yeah. I don't know that either. I do know that, you know, the Marine Corps is supposed to be the responsible for the safety of our ambassadors. And in fact, only about 25% of our Foreign Service officers have any Marine Corps protection. Over the last 30 years, it's been more and more outsourced to private contractors. And in fact, the two guys who are doing security for was it Chris Stevens, the name of our ambassador, and the other fellow who died? The two other people who died with them were private contractors. And
actually chose this facility? It would seem to me, I'm not an expert in security, but how about a video surveillance, and how about some sprinkler system? And instead of this swimming pool, how about a bomb shelter? How about, let's think security.
Yeah.
What was really going on up there? Were the kids in the neighborhood ever invited to use the pool?
I don't know. What's your point?
It just seems like they're trying to get to the bottom of Benghazi.
They're not trying to get to the bottom of anything, Bill. What they're trying to do is smear the president. There have been 10 or 12, maybe 14 of these kinds of things. In fact, maybe it's even more than that. I had a list. We did a show on this back about 6 months ago. There's been like 10, 12, 15 of these situations where Foreign Service officers have been killed, and most of them occurred on the watch of George W. Bush or his father. And if you look over the last 30 years, there were a couple during Bill Clinton's presidency. There was one during Obama's presidency. And nobody says a peep about any of the rest of them. But as soon as, you know, one happens while Obama is president, and especially while, you know, Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State, that's what this is really all about, Bill, is one thing and one thing only. And that is is coming up with a cudgel that they can use to beat up Hillary Clinton if she becomes the Democratic Party's nominee for president. And they are trying to hammer her down before she even stands up. And that's what it's all about. It is all about politics. It is partisan politics and nothing more, nothing less. That's it.
Thank you, and I agree 100%.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bill. And this, by the way, is, of course, why Fox News is all over this. Why Fox News, if anything happens in the world, what does Fox News talk about? Benghazi. Because, you know, it's GOP TV. Roger Ailes suggested this to Richard Nixon back when he was in the Nixon White House. Nixon couldn't come up with the money. Roger eventually found a billionaire in Rupert Murdoch and created GOP TV. And they call it Fox so-called news. Or Fox News. I call it Fox so-called news. Anyway, we'll be back 10 minutes before. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity in South Sudan, where this country is just going through hell right now, with Victoria Jones, the reporter. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well,
very pretty flowers behind you.
Thank you, fuchsia orchid.
Ah, very nice.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Nice. It was almost an interesting briefing at the White House today.
Yeah, almost?
That's not the news. Well, it rarely is, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, like that. It was almost interesting because of the questions about Benghazi. You were talking about it.
Oh, really?
Press secretary and boy detective, as Joel McHale, the comic at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, referred to Jay Carney.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite apt, was peppered with. And he did not respond directly, did not quite suggest, but did not deny anyway. He was unclear over whether the White House would or would not cooperate with the Benghazi House Select Committee investigating the terror attacks in Benghazi.
Mm.
He said the White House has always cooperated with legitimate oversight.
but not illegitimate oversight.
He didn't have to say it. He called the new probe a highly partisan effort to politicize the attack.
Yes.
He said if you look at even what some Republicans have said, it certainly cast doubt on the legitimacy of an effort that is so partisan in nature. He said, I don't think there are many people, including some Republicans, who believe that this is necessary after 7 congressional committees and multiple investigations. One thing is Congress is not short on its investigations into what happened before, during, after Benghazi. And he went on, he talked about the facts, and he kept referring to, and it'll be interesting to see, Jay has a tendency to come up with themes or memes and not stick to them.
Hmm.
Somebody should tell him to stick to them, because he had quite a good one today. It was investigations into investigations into investigations.
Hmm.
If he sticks to that for the next 7 or 8 months or until the 2016 elections, as Representative Peter King intimated today, he's on to something.
Yeah.
He also said, interestingly, at some point you just have to assume Republicans will continue this because it feeds a political objective at some point. The facts begin not to matter to those who fervently want to believe something else.
Hmm.
He also chided Republicans for not focusing on issues Americans really care about, like the economy, and he went into some details. The effort to politicize this has continued unabated. He also made several references to the continued votes to try to repeal and repeal and repeal a law that has provided private health coverage for 8 million Americans.
Interesting.
He was quite punchy, the boy detective, today.
Good on him. By the way, a question. You were at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I take it.
Resplendent in gold, yes.
No doubt. I was out of town. And so I didn't see it. I saw the president's speech this morning. I watched it on the web. But I didn't see the comedians. But I heard from a couple of people that the comedian called on Lindsey Graham to come out of the closet. Do I have that right?
He didn't quite do that, but he did say that he'd played Blanche DuBois.
Blanche DuBois.
Card name desire, yes.
Okay. All right. close enough. I was just curious.
Close enough.
Just curious. So anyhow, what else is going on in the world?
He did skewer. You know, but he was pilloried on Twitter, Joel McHale. The only thing he should have
for
been
saying that.
For, I mean, he really was during his, after his remarks. Hmm. And he did read from notes, which I thought he could have memorized his stuff.
Right.
But I thought he was on point, tart, and much funnier than most of the material I've seen him deliver before. I think in years to come, this is going to go down as a pretty good delivery. I thought he was pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. Well, I read that in your news notes this morning, and you noted that when Stephen Colbert did it, he was attacked for being highly partisan. And then people look back on it now and go, oh, that was one of the best ones.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court ruled today, 5-4, that the small town of Greece in upstate New York did not violate the Constitution by starting its public meetings with a prayer from a chaplain of the month who was almost always Christian, with prayers saying things like references to the saving sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross.
All right. And this was a 5-4 decision.
5-4.
Yeah.
Justice Anthony Kennedy said that the prayers were merely ceremonial. They were neither unduly sectarian nor likely to make members of other faiths feel unwelcome, which is exactly what the two people suing said they did feel.
Right. Yeah, I think this is did you see the piece in the New York Times today about how Antonin Scalia and other justices, they all say they're in favor of free speech, but the conservative justices rule in favor of free speech for conservatives, and the liberal justices rule in favor of free speech for liberals?
Yeah, I saw the graph.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty impressive.
Fascinating.
I think this is another example of that.
Fascinating.
The Supreme White Court has House, too much power.
Yeah. White House Senior Advisor John Podesta came to the briefing, too. He today indicated that President Obama would veto the energy efficiency bill set to go before the Senate this week if it passes with, quote, unacceptable riders, which is pretty much clearly a reference to the Keystone XL pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we hope that it passes, but if it passes with unacceptable riders, then it will be headed to the watery depths.
Oh, that's a sweet metaphor.
Yeah. He also said that the efforts in the Senate, and particularly the House, to stop the administration from using its authority under the Clean Air Act will, quote, have 0% chance of working. We are committed to moving forward on those rules. We are committed to maintaining the president's authority. He said the administration's on track to propose carbon limits for existing power plants by early June.
Wow. Wow. In advance of the election, this is going to become very politicized, I predict.
The president will be making more announcements about his climate agenda tomorrow. And
there you go.
And a number of interviews with meteorologists.
Yeah. The president, using the power of his pen, it's going to make Phyllis Schlafly's head explode. She was on our program in the first hour. In any case, Victoria Jones, thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great to see you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And very pleased to be relieved that a lot of stuff that we've been talking about throughout the day. But there was an interesting conversation that I was reading over in the Daily Banter this morning. And I started there. Tommy Christopher is going to be on our TV show tonight, and he's writing for them on a regular basis now. But I saw this piece about this guy who's basically kind of stalking Shepard Smith, the Fox News host, who's one of the more rational voices over at Fox. And apparently the correspondence dinners, the comedian, I was not there, I didn't hear it, I was on the West Coast. I've been to several of them in the past, but not this one. But apparently the host made a joke that could be inferred as Lindsey Graham is in the closet. And this guy is all about Shepard Smith. And it's like, shouldn't people, even people in the media, be able to have a private life? And I think that the conversation about the conversation is a really interesting one. And Chez Pazienza has been talking about that over at the Daily Banter, thedailybanter.com, and you know, with some very thoughtful pieces. And so I just wanted to open that conversation. Chez, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm well, and thank you for joining us. So give me the backstory here.
On Trotter, J.K. Trotter is a writer for Gawker who, since, I want to say October of last year, has written somewhere in the neighborhood of like four or five now pieces, the sole intention of which is basically to out Shepard Smith. You know, from the beginning, I haven't really been able to figure out why, because, you know, just on the surface, someone's sexuality isn't really new, someone's sexual orientation. I think the point Trotter has been trying to make is that there's some sort of hypocrisy involved because Shep works for Fox News. I disagree with that. I think that while, you know, Fox has its, you know, very obvious right-wing leanings, Shep has never said anything personally that's sort of anti-gay. But Trotter, you know, doesn't care. Trotter has been trying to sort of, you know, make it known that Shep's gay, which, by the way, the worst kept secret in television news.
Yeah.
Seriously.
So, yeah, and
I've
let's
known Shep for 20 something years.
Yeah. And not unlike Anderson Cooper and, you know,
right.
who finally just came out and said it. But that, you know, setting that aside, I mean, I have a lot of respect actually for Shepard Smith and I don't know him personally. I've never met him, but, you know, he seems like probably the one sane voice over at Fox News. And, you know, whether he's gay or straight, you know, he's a decent journalist and a decent reporter. And that's pretty important. There was this very loud debate actually a couple of years ago. We had on several people who were involved in it, and Dan Savage was sort of at the epicenter of it. He was on our program a number of times about whether there is even an obligation of people in the gay community who know, you know, by the gay community, who know somebody who is gay, who is working against the gay community. And I think they were talking specifically about largely legislators, Republican legislators who were voting in ways that were openly destructive, all the way back to the Reagan era, you know, with the AIDS meltdown debacle, and, you know, to the modern era. And I think that, you know, that hypocrisy argument is actually a strong argument. But
I think it is. I think that if you're a policymaker and you're gay, and you're keeping it a secret for the good of your office, and you're creating policy, or you're being, even if you're being a cultural figure that really stands sort of stridently against gay rights or gay issues, then yeah, I would think that you've, you know, I can't speak from experience for the gay community, but I would think that would be a problem, and I think I'd be much less against the idea of just, you know, randomly outing somebody, if that were the case.
Right. I really debated with myself and with my producers, with Sean and Louise, you know, whether we should even do this topic on the air, because I don't want to be part of outing Shep, except for the fact that, as you said, it's the worst kept secret in television news. It's yeah. it's you know it's and I do think that the I guess my question to you is the subtext of what Mr. Trotter is doing by turning this into a crusade basically and stalking Shepard Smith, is what he's doing really the homophobic stuff that's going on here, or functionally? I mean, you know, is he doing something that suggests somehow that there's something wrong with being gay, or something wrong with being gay and wanting it not to be, you know, your principal public face, or even wanting it to be in the closet about it? I don't see anything wrong with that, and I don't get, you know, your thoughts on that.
I don't know Trotter personally, so I can't speak to what his, you know, in his heart or whatever, what his, what his intentions are, what his motives are for this.
Right.
But he is kind of, at first when he sort of tried to out Shep, he did it in this kind of skeevy roundabout way, which is he told this story about Shep going to get a drink at a bar in Manhattan and getting into an argument with a waitress. And about halfway through the piece, it's like Shep was there with his, with this man, and they were canoodling and this. And it's like, all right, if you're going to do it, at least have the balls to do it. Don't be smarmy about it and try to make it look like that wasn't, you didn't bury the lead.
Right.
Because
right.
It really is. And again, he's followed it up again and again with trying to make this into a story. And, I said from the very beginning that it's not a story unless he can prove that Shep being gay, or Shep's, I'm not even going to say gay or straight, Shep's sexual orientation has a bearing on his standing at work at Fox.
Right.
If he can prove that, then obviously there is a story there. Then it becomes news. And I think that this piece that he wrote last week, where he talked about how Shep was essentially, as he put it, shoved back into the closet by Fox News.
Yeah, that was the headline.
Yeah, the story was that Shep wanted to come out, and that Ailes and Bill Shine and people like that didn't want Shep coming out, and that by Shep's pushing, he was demoted. That's why
right.
he's on 3 p.m. now instead of in prime time, that kind of thing.
Right.
And, if that's a true story, then it's one thing. But that story very, very quickly fell apart.
Right, because Bill Shine was not at the meeting that he claimed he was at and
right.
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and now Trotter's trying to backtrack and say, well, you know, we got that wrong, but hey, every other thing that we got is right. And he's continuing to do it by putting forward, this is inside baseball, but he's doing it, he's continuing to do it by putting forward, his quote unquote Fox News sources. And these are anonymous sources.
Right.
There are some news organizations, journalistic organizations that can get away with putting anonymous sources out there. Gawker is not one of them.
Right. Which raises the question, to what extent is this just clickbait? Are they just doing this to get people to click through to the site?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they got traction last week on that story from pretty decent, journalists or people who follow media. I mean, one of the ways that I first found out about it wasn't through the actual Gawker link. It was the fact that the Daily Beast had written about it and Slate had written about it.
Right.
And I'm like, all right, well, look, you know what? I can't stand the idea that, because it's the easiest, cheapest way to relieve yourself of journalistic responsibility while still getting clickbait, is to do the, well, we're reporting on the controversy.
Right.
But it did get picked up enough to where I'm like, all right, look, I have no choice. I have to.
Well, I think there's a story here about the morality of clickbait, but we're out of time. But we've opened the conversation, and I'd like to have the conversation be about what's going on at Gawker, not at Fox. Shez, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Tom. I appreciate it.
Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Shez Pazienza, you can read his writings over at thedailybanter.com. Great work. Great reporting. Thank you, sir. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, you wanted to talk about West Virginia? Steve watching Free Speech TV? No, Steve. Okay, let's see if Pat in Windsor, South Carolina can hear me. Pat.
I can hear you.
Okay, great. What's on your mind today, Pat?
Oh, I just want to thank you for this program. I just think it's wonderful. Many people have much to say. My concern today is dealing with, we always usually talk about deadbeat fathers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to talk about deadbeat deadbeat moms today, kind of take a little different direction. A lot of these mothers, some of them now, we have a lot of cases that are through the DSS where they're putting children on men, knowing that they're not the father of these children. And I just want the guys out there to know that they have a right to ask for a DNA. And a lot of these guys are not aware of their rights, and they're being thrown in jail. And
are you talking about for child support?
Yes, for child support, and also for in regards to them being asked, being put as the father by mothers who know from the jump that they're not the father of these children. I'm going through it right now with my husband. He's had two children put on him, and the second child, she admitted, wasn't his after 8 years. Long story. But what I'm trying to say is that I want these men to know that they do have rights.
Yeah.
When they go up for this. And if the person says that this child is there, they have a right to ask for a DNA.
Okay.
My husband was denied a DNA. Matter of fact, thrown in jail. Then when he came out, they gave him a DNA. And now they still can't tell him he's the father.
Wow. Wow.
So I just want.
It's a mess.
You know, we always go with the deadbeat fathers, but we need to talk about some of these moms that don't want to hold their end up either and just want to get, you know, checks and money from the government, knowing that these children aren't the fathers that they're saying.
Okay. Well, Pat, you just did it. You just got the message out, and thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing that. That's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating story. Whoops. Hang on just a second. Austin, I'm going to have to come back to you in just a second. Tony in Terre Haute, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Tony, what's up? Tony? I'm wondering if maybe some of our lines are crashing. Susan in Wana, Washington, watching Free Speech TV. Are you there, Susan? I wonder if our phones have gone down. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, he's on line six. He's in the second part.
Talking about talking past each other and not understanding what each other's saying.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're absolutely right. The middle class is not understanding what you're saying. Our understanding of the economy is that we had a manufacturing economy. We lost it.
Right.
Then they said we were a service economy. Right. Well, without manufacturing, there's nothing to service, so it lost. So then they started the housing bubble, talking us into buying houses we couldn't afford with these new instruments such as low introductory interest rates for the first 12 years.
Right.
And then it went up to the point they convinced us.
Right, and now they're trying to hustle us into the stock market with 401ks and stuff.
Yeah, well, you see, there's another thing with the 401ks. The middle-class people, they invest in mutual funds, right?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stocks in there that are trash.
Yeah.
Right? So while you're at work, they're trashing your stocks that were already
there. Yeah. Yeah, this all came with Reaganomics. Reagan was the guy who invented all this stuff, and it was to get people out of pensions and into the market, so that they would identify with rich people, and so Wall Street could make money off it. Corky, thanks for the call. So, lots of interesting stuff here. America doesn't give a rat's patootie about the poor, we've talked about. We were just talking with Chez Pazienza about really the... To what extent should people in the media be able to have a private life? To what extent does the media have some sort of obligation to honor that? I think this raises a lot of interesting questions. We talked about WAMEND, Washington Amend, Move to Amend in Washington. They're working very, very hard at that. And, of course, in our first hour, we opened with Phyllis Schlafly, who was from eagleforum.org, who, interestingly, was talking about how our Supreme Court is totally out of control and acting unconstitutionally and has been largely for the last 50 or 60 years. And I absolutely agree with her. And B, that our trade policies are insane and that we're sending all our jobs overseas. And that this is, you know, and here is somebody who is as conservative as they can get. And I'm about as liberal as you can get. And we're looking at these principles. Now, you know, we have different issues, different reasons for being concerned about these principles, but looking at the principles, It was fascinating. I thought it was a fascinating conversation. So, Susan in Wanna, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up?
I just wanted to mention on the Keystone, I really think it's going to go through, but watching C-SPAN last Friday, Mary Landrieu was on it, and she has sided with the Republicans of pushing that whole.
Well, she sided with the oil industry because she's from Louisiana, and the oil industry owns Louisiana. So,
but
you know,
does she not realize that with the last disaster, such as Deepwater, that all that became like a swirling cesspool and still is?
Well, it's either, you know, she's very frightened that she's going to lose her election, and I think that she's being badly.
Her soul.
I beg your pardon?
I said, how much can she sell her soul for?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Susan, thank you for the call. I think she's being badly advised. I think that Democrats, red state Democrats, like Mary Landrieu, should be reaching, they should be doing a Bernie Sanders. They should not be doing a Rahm Emanuel or a Bill Clinton. Instead of moving to the middle, they should be moving to the left. They should be, instead of going corporate, they should go populist. They should be talking to the people. And, you know, it's just, now, it may be that the way that Mary Landrieu is framing her pro-oil position and pro-Keystone XL pipeline, well, not maybe. I mean, she is framing it as a populist issue. This is going to bring jobs, you know, it's going to. Well, yeah, sort of. Maybe 3,000 jobs, maybe for a year or two. You can't make a good argument for it. And Harry Reid is going to help these folks out because the political advisors in the Democratic Party are saying to the so-called red state Democrats, you know, you gotta get with the program. So anyway, Johnson in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Johnson, you wanted to talk about the Shep Smith discussion?
Yes, Bob. Well, let me first say that thank you for all the inspiration you've given me.
You're welcome. Thank you for your kind words.
So much for flattery. Yes, the idea of privacy for public figures is not all public figures, but for media people, it strikes me as odd. These are the same people who shove a microphone in somebody's face and ask, your son just went down on that ferry, how do you feel?
Yeah, no, I understand. And in fact, the law says that both Shep Smith and I have basically no right to claim privacy, that anybody can say anything about us, whether it's true or not, and we can't sue them the way that you could, for example, as a private figure, that we basically, unless we can prove really egregious intent to harm, we don't have the ability to claim libel or slander.
And the second point, I guess, is the context that goes to. I'm sorry, did I get cut off?
No, you're still on.
Sorry. This is an old quote. We had to destroy that village in order to save it.
Right.
Paul Ryan wanted to. Had to destroy Social Security in order to save it for the old people.
Yeah, that's what he says.
We can't raise the minimum wage because we will throw all these people into poverty because we can't afford their higher wages.
Right.
So
up is down, in is out.
Yes, whatever seemingly argument you want to make about people being hypocritical about gay people, it'll get the same twist.
Yeah.
What do they call that? 1984.
Well, yeah. What I was curious about is that at what point, you know, has this whole Gawker story become no longer about Shepard Smith and more really about the reporter? And is this reporter going off on in a way that's not, shall we say, not good for gay people, or at least gay people in the media? And I, you know, not being a gay person in the media, I don't know. I'm straight guy. Anyhow, Johnson, thanks for the call. I just thought it was thought provoking, and I'm not sure where to go with that. You know, it's not like one of those things where you can say, "Here's the issue."
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think it just raises some issues about journalistic integrity and where do we draw the lines in this business and where should they be drawn. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Did you see the Supreme Court turn down Chris Hedges' request for them to hear his case where he's suing basically to have part of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, overturned? I think it's called Section 201. This part that says that the military, at the president's request, can arrest you and hold you without due process, without access to a lawyer, which is, as I recall, the Sixth Amendment, without access to a trial, the Seventh Amendment, speedy trial, without, you know, in a way that would be considered cruel and unusual punishment, the Eighth Amendment, you know, being locked up for the whole rest of your life in solitary confinement. And they can do this, you know, and try to compel you to indict yourself, essentially, in violation of the Fifth Amendment, and deprive you of life and liberty in violation of the Fifth Amendment. They can do all of this simply by designating you a terrorist or a sponsor of terrorists or a friend of terrorists or whatever. I don't have the exact language in front of me, but it's pretty damn broad. Now, the president, when he signed this, he added a signing statement saying, I'm not going to do this. Well, that's fine. I frankly doubt that President Obama would do it. But would President McCain? Would President Palin? Would President Lindsey Graham or Steve King or Joe Lieberman or, we can go through a list of kind of right-wing whack jobs. And we have a history in this country of periodically putting crazy right-wingers in the White House. And do you really want them to have the power to put anybody in jail forever with no recourse to the courts? Really? And the Supreme Court today, or yesterday, or earlier in the week, said to Chris Hedges, no, sorry, we're not going to hear your case. You don't get to take apart the NDAA. We're not going to rule on the constitutionality of this. And it seems to me like of all the cases where it's obvious, they wouldn't even grant this cert. I mean, they wouldn't even hear the case, which means that they couldn't get four justices to say, yes, let's hear the case. Now, I'm guessing that probably Kagan had to recuse herself from that process. And that leaves only three liberals on the court. And they could not get a single conservative to go along with them on granting cert. Granting cert means saying, yes, we'll hear the case. Certiorari, is it? Certiorari. Thank you. Graduate of law school. Shano. You know these big words that I don't know. Anyhow, Stephen in New York City. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hey, how are you? I wanted to call about I'm forgetting his name right now.
Shepard Smith, well, Gawker,
yeah,
all that.
Shepard Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, Shepard Smith. I always figured that, you know, instead of trying to figure out why he's doing it, usually when somebody that doesn't want to be out, it's usually a retaliation. So maybe this person's getting back at him for something. You know,
could be, or it could just be that he's trying to build his career as a journalist on this, but I think that that's a crummy way to do it, frankly.
Yeah, it's a nowhere story. It's going to disappear soon. The other thing that, and your story reminded me, the Supreme Court decision on air pollution.
Yeah.
Crossing from one state to another.
Yeah, this was.
Use that in Monsanto and their GMO pollen blowing into people's fields.
You're right. It contradicts. The Supreme Court has ruled that Monsanto can continue to sue people because, you know, when their pollen blows over into their fields.
Right. So if they're going to say that one state can prevent another state from polluting their state, why can't the farmer prevent Monsanto from polluting their crops?
Well, I think probably that latter case did not involve two states. It involved people within the same state. But technicality. But I frankly don't know. I think that this might be. Well, I don't know. I would just be guessing. But excellent point, Stephen. Excellent point. Thanks for calling and bringing it up. Ed in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hey, Ed.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. How are you today?
I am great. You wanted to talk about the senatorial influence on the Tennessee Union vote?
Oh, isn't that something? I had come in over the weekend and flew in on Friday and kind of wanted to bring light to this kind of interference by our senator here.
Is it Bob Corker?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. And I was able to meet momentarily during the AFL-CIO book signing for Elizabeth Warren. And I was hoping to bring a little bit more light to this. And she agreed that it was pretty shameful thing of what he had done. So over the weekend, we had a healthy discussion over at the Lamont Street Collective. And I got to talk to several people in the trade to get their ideas and their understandings of what they thought about it. And your name had come up for me to possibly talk to. It was a gentleman by the name of Cole from In These Times. And he wanted to think that maybe my better voices from Chattanooga, where I'm back at now, would be to help kind of bring this up on your show and then maybe even, you know, get a conversation talking further and further. And maybe other people in other states are seeing and feeling that they have their senators are having their pockets in their best interest instead of their constituents.
Yeah, well, that's,
and hopefully bring up something against it.
Yeah, that's increasingly the case, tragically. Excellent point, Ed. And feel free to tell the reporter from In These Times or anybody else, if you've got a news hook, I mean, if something has happened in this story recently that brings it back into the news, that makes it worth talking about, or if it's just, you know, such an egregious story that even on an ongoing basis, somebody should be covering it like us, to pitch it to Sean Taylor, who is our producer. She's the gatekeeper, as it were, for the stories and our guests. She books all of our guests, 100% of our guests. And she and Louise, my wife, produce this program. And, you know, with input from me, but it's like, you know, they are the ones that need to be talked to. Although you yourself, Ed, just now brought it up on national television and radio, and good on you for doing that. I think what Bob Corker did was shameful, and I applaud Volkswagen for basically being publicly dismayed by what happened. And, you know, we'll see where this goes, because they've got these workers' councils in Germany, and they work very well. They like that. So, Ed, thanks for the call, and good talking to you. Gordon in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Gordon, thanks for listening to 950. What's up?
Hey, hang on a second, Tom. You got to get where I can talk here.
Okay.
Okay. I just wanted to get a better understanding of the what they're trying to do here in Washington State concerning getting the money out of politics. I have a pretty good understanding of what we need to do here, basically get enough signatures in order to get, I'm assuming, an initiative on the ballot.
It would be an initiative, and it would be on the ballot, but it's not an initiative that does anything other than simply putting the voters of the state of Washington on record as being in support of a constitutional amendment that would assert that corporations do not have rights under the 14th Amendment and that money does not have rights under the First Amendment.
Do all 50 states have to do this? And
no.
If so, how are we going to? Okay, because I was wondering how we're going to get Mississippi, Alabama, Oklahoma.
Yeah, in order for a constitutional amendment to be passed, it has to pass the House and Senate, 2/3 of the Senate, and I don't know if it's 2/3 of the House or simple majority, but I think it might be 2/3. And then it has to pass 3/4 of the states. And if you've got enough people who've got their dander up about it, you get enough people who are really upset about it, and this was basically my TED Talk in Portland on Saturday, then it can happen very quickly. The 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 21 down to 18 in 1971 during the height of the Vietnam War, that amendment passed. From the time it was dropped in Congress until the time the 3/4 state ratified it was 3 months and 8 days. I mean, so it can be done very quickly. And the part of the TED Talk that I forgot to say, because you're not allowed to walk up there with notes, which is very upsetting, but the part that I forgot to say is that it's not just you and me, it's not just the average person who really wants to get money out of politics. I have met in this town certainly a lot of Democrats, but also a surprising number of Republicans who, in a heartbeat, if the Supreme Court's policy was overturned by constitutional amendment and therefore they could pass something like McCain-Feingold, they could get money out of politics, they could even go to public financing of elections, they would do it in a heartbeat, because these legislators, they want to be legislating. They don't want to be spending 5 and 6 hours a day renting a room someplace in this, like in this building where we're broadcasting from, where, you know, there's a couple dozen rooms here in this building that are rented to members of Congress because we're just two blocks from the Capitol. They walk over here and they sit on the phone for 4 or 5 hours every day begging for money, and they hate it. The Republicans hate it as much as the Democrats hate it. So you're seeing a coalition emerge. The companies, the big companies, the Chamber of Commerce kind of types of companies, they're beginning to dislike this because they're feeling like they're being hit up all the time. The politicians hate it, and the people hate it. The only people who like it are a small number of very influential billionaires, basically the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson, the very prominent billionaires who love the fact that now they have politicians who have to come kiss their ring and introduce their legislation. So I think this could really fly. Gordon, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. And you can drop into our free live chat room at TomHartman.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nelson in Remmer, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Nelson, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am well, thank you. You wanted to talk about Marsha Blackburn?
Yes, I am a victim of gerrymandering, of course.
And so she's a Republican, as I recall. She is your congresswoman?
Yes, she is.
Okay.
Let me give you a couple things real quick. When they voted and approved the Iran budget, I sent her a quick email. Asking how Medicare would be changed, what would happen to Medicaid, SNAP, Bureau of Indian Affairs, a long list of things. Mm-hmm. A couple of weeks later, I got a reply back giving me about the military budget.
Right.
So,
yeah, here's just a hint, Nelson, for future. They basically have a list of positions and a list of policies. And you will get back a letter that is a form letter from most members of Congress. But they do keep track of what you wrote about. And so they look at and they say, you know, gee, we've got, 90-1. Our constituents are in favor of net neutrality and opposed to the Comcast merger or something like that. And so when you contact your member of Congress, keep each contact to one single issue. And that way it will get noted. It'll be kept track of, and you know it'll get checkmarked in the column. If you do more than one issue, your email or your letter is more likely to be ignored or to not be registered. Just FYI.
Okay. Well,
I mean, you can send five separate emails on five separate topics. That's better than sending one email with five topics in it.
Okay. I'll do that next time.
Good.
Well, today... Well, Friday, she sends out a weekly This Week in Washington newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And she was all excited about this upcoming investigative committee that the speaker is going to come up with.
About Benghazi?
Right.
Yeah.
About Benghazi.
Yeah.
So I put out another email about that, and told her that that was a colossal waste of time.
Mm.
And
money.
Right, and that other things should be done, like working on unemployment, the environment, jobs creation, and a few other things like that would actually benefit the American citizens.
Yep. Well, Nelson, let me encourage you to go a step beyond that. I mean, it's good to communicate with your congresswoman, even when you're opposite her politically. But you might want to contact the local Democratic Party and see if they need any help See if you can, you know, make some phone calls, some canvassings, you know, do any kind of volunteer work. Even though you're in a gerrymandered district, that doesn't mean all is lost. And there are also state races that you should be paying attention to. Who's in your, you know, who's your state senator and your state representative, and what can you do about that? So there's still a lot of opportunity for you to be a change agent. I'm sure you're probably taking advantage of many of those. Nelson, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. I told you about this a week or so ago. There was this fascinating story in Science about how depression-causing mechanisms, boosting these depression-causing mechanisms in the brain increases resilience. To achieve resiliency when under social stress, the brain must perform a complex balancing act in which negative stress-related changes in the brain actively trigger positive changes. In other words, hey, you know, this country's got a lot of problems, but don't let it get you down. Let it get you active. Do something about it. That's always the best stress reliever. Raymond in Hemp Hill, Texas. Hey, Raymond, what's up?
Hi, Tom. What I was calling you for on your No More Billionaires campaign, I think in the face of this climate change, if we really want to do something, and unfortunately it don't seem like too many people give it much of a thought, we would have to be somewhere closer to No More Millionaires, because we need to redefine prosperity and find out some way to have prosperity for a lot less.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, but you got to start someplace. And I figured.
That's. I think you have a good start.
Yeah.
And of course, you need incentives too.
Yeah.
But one other point, I've been thinking about with the Republicans and everything. Seem to be religion with them. And I kind of believe, I might be wrong on this, that religion is a inherited, the ability of religion is, I think, going to be just like the ability of language, inherited from birth. And I think in some ways we might process the economy and such in our brain the same way we do religion. So in a way they might be onto something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a possibility. I think that we are
looking at religion and economy as two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, well, I think we're wired for religion for two reasons. One, in part, we use religion to try to make sense out of things we can't make sense out of otherwise. And over time, science has come to replace a lot of that. You know, why is there lightning and thunder and things like that? But then also, I think that there's this sense of you know, there are certain emotions that we have. A love, awe, wonder, that there are regions of the brain associated with that kind of fire together for some people in a religious context, when they pray or when they have a moment of, you know, religious ecstasy or whatever. And interestingly, there seems to be a strong relationship between the intensity with which people feel religion and the likelihood they are to be epileptic, which I thought was fascinating. But it indicates that there is, you know, there is a whole book published about this about a decade ago called The God Spot, I think it was called. And it was about this region of the brain that they had isolated that seems to have something to do with religion. Anyhow, Raymond, thanks for the thought and the call. Bill in Cross Timbers, Missouri. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I heard you say a comment about the security of the ambassadors and our, but we do that through the regulations of the Geneva Convention back probably 100 and some odd years ago, and we have the right to furnish security inside to destroy secret documents and that kind of stuff, but the host company is supposed to supply the security to the outside.
Yeah.
And for that reason, most embassies are located on one street, and that's a gated community to help the security.
Yeah. Well, this wasn't an embassy. This was a consulate. It was sort of like, you know, a remote office. And, And as I said, you know, this isn't the only time or the only person who has died in the service of the State Department. It's just the only one that has happened that the Republicans think they can politicize. Bill, thanks for the call. Eileen in Turner, Oregon, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Eileen, what's up?
Hi, how are you? I've met you when you were in Salem.
Great. Well, thank you.
And I used to call KPOG all the time, and I'm Carl Wolfson's West Coast Den leader.
Oh, great. Carl's a good guy.
Anyway, this is about Benghazi. I was wondering, you mentioned that you had previously listed attacks during the two Bush administrations.
Yes.
Could you post those on your Facebook page?
I'll have to track them down. We it's been 6 months since we did a show on it, and in fact, I think the first place I saw it was over at Democratic Underground. But I will track that down. I'll do my best, Eileen. I'll try and find it.
Okay, because then we could send it to our Congress people.
Yeah, I think Think Progress might have done something on that too. But let me see what I can do. In fact, I'll try and track it down tonight and report back to you tomorrow, okay?
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot.
And the other issue, I know it's horrible because he was a wonderful person, but has anybody asked why Ambassador Stevens went there on 9/11? Wasn't it an unnecessary risk that he took? And did he ask Clinton if he could go, should go? I mean, why would he go on that day when everybody knew it was not a secure place and he had allegedly?
It's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it, frankly, and I don't, you know, what we have learned since then is that this was basically a CIA station as much as or maybe even more than it was an embassy. And but, you know, what he was doing, I don't know. It's not something that – this is something that the State Department needs to figure out and the Marine Corps, and not something that but I'm telling you, Fox News doesn't care about those things. They simply want to try to use this to tar, you know, to resin up to make sticky Hillary Clinton and in case she runs for president. That's what it's all about, really what it's all about. So, anyhow, don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not enough to just stand on the sidelines and throw stones and yell and call talk radio. Get out there, get active, do something. Tag, you're it. So we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.